Accession number 12708, RW Hawksworth, reel 10.
Mr. RW Hawksworth, reel 10. What activities were you personally involved in Interbrook?
I wasn't actively engaged on any raids or fighting patrols or recce patrols, although on one occasion I accompanied the CO on a visit to the forward companies, where he deliberately displayed himself in order to draw fire from the enemy positions in order to locate them on his battle map.
How did he do this?
He fired in one occasion. He deliberately fired a flare towards the enemy in order to draw their fire, and the reply was immediately forthcoming.
How did you feel being involved in this particular activity?
I didn't feel much at all. I was flat on the ground most of the time.
Who was the colonel?
Colonel Kirby, John Kirby.
So Ardern had left you then, had he?
Yes, Colonel Ardern had gone then. Yeah.
Was he the type of person that did this kind of thing? This, what it would appear, almost foolhardy?
Colonel Kirby was a fearless man. I can't remember any other instances, but this wasn't his first effort in this respect. Other chaps would tell you similar stories. How he set about in his own manner to achieve things which would have been set up in a different setup by other people. But he was, once he'd made up his mind to do something or have something done, it was carried out.
Away from the front line situation in Tobruk, in this very narrow area, what other units and situations were there? Were you backed up by other units?
We saw little of the flanking units, people on our left and right, we saw very little of. We, in our situation at Battalion Quarters, were some distance away in any case, so we weren't able. Certainly the forward companies, the rifle companies, would have been in close contact with them on more than one occasion, in combined patrol activities, etc. But that we were, of course, part of a defensive line of the men around the perimeter, and close contact was made by means of wireless.
Did you have many casualties while you were there?
No. I think, considering that the fact that we're in a beleaguered town, as the Rommel called a self-contained prisoners of war situation, our casualties were not severe.
Was there much left of Tobruk town?
I never got into Tobruk town, but during moonlit nights and on occasions when the Germans were across dropping flares in order to identify the bombing target, one could see that whatever was left of it was largely heaps of rubble and broken down houses.
Had any of the natives survived in the town, or had they gone when the siege started?
I never saw an Arab in my tour of the Brook perimeter. Never saw a native.
You had your own medical situation. Was there a hospital within the sieged area?
Yes, there was. There was a field hospital situated well to the rear in some caves, if I remember rightly, to which the severely wounded were transported and eventually shipped back to Alexandria or other place in Egypt by the Royal Navy.
All your supplies must have come up through the sea, using ships.
There is no doubt whatsoever that had it not been for the Royal Navy, we would not have survived. All supplies came in by sea. There was not sufficient landing space for aircraft delivery within the perimeter in any case. At the airfield at El Adam was somewhere between the perimeter and the German lines.
What was the food situation? Was it in plentiful supply, or what kind of food were you getting?
The food in Tobruk was good. We were never short of food, and we inherited from the Australian brigade, who relieved a terrific amount of food. We also had a variety of food in Tobruk. We were issued with Australian rations, South African rations, British Army rations. Generally speaking, the food situation was quite good. I certainly never went hungry.
The water situation, was it okay?
The water was good. The people responsible, the engineers, had cleaned several of the wells, springs in the perimeter area, and the water, strangely, it was not brackish. It was good to drink in most cases.
Being under siege and under observation in such a small area, what kind of effect did that have upon you and your comrades?
Well, the area was it was a bare area, and the atmosphere was that of one felt hemmed in most of the time. Usually in these situations, one can organise sporting events or other distractions. However, being in this position where we were constantly under observation in some parts of the sector, unnecessary movement on a large scale was discouraged, and in fact exceedingly dangerous. To this end, apart from possible beach parties in the sector nearest to the sea, there was little or no activity. And although one didn't become bored, certainly in our rear area of the battalion, one wonders how the men in the fighting pits on the front line got over this situation. They must have been extremely bored from time to time.
Did you experience any men who came back from the front line situation under stress? Or?
We never had any Durham men come through, certainly not through our aid post, suffering from this ill effect. No, it didn't. They were a tough lot, a tough bunch, and I suppose they knew they were there for a purpose. And all the exercise and activity they needed, they got during the night when they went through the wire.
At any time during the time that you were there, were you ever pulled back a little way into any rest situation?
Well, there wasn't a lot of room to go resting. There were lots of gullies and dry wadi beds. But these were mainly occupied by equipment that moved out at night, and there were restricted areas. There were also, inside the perimeter, certain mined areas in case we had to pull out. And so, there wasn't all that room. We were told, in fact, that line which we occupied had to be held, and that was the end of it.
Do you recall any particular engagements against any German positions whilst you were in Tobruk?
Yes, one in particular was a company attack, a night attack on a German position nicknamed Plonk, for reasons I never discovered. It took place on the night of the 9th of November 1941. The D Company were chosen to carry out this raid in force, destroy the enemy, and if possible, secure two or three prisoners. Previously, patrols had been sent forward to reconnoitre the approach area and the wire protecting the position in Plonk, and gradually a picture was built up on the battle plan to assist the officer in charge of the raiding party. On the night in question, 9th of November, at first dark, with the supporting arms in readiness, D Company sallied forth through the wire and began their attack. Odd bursts of fire, as usual, came across. D Company held their fire and awaiting the order to commence firing. And much to their surprise, near to the start point for the final assault, they encountered a wire obstacle which had not been previously reported. This consisted of a wide band of barbed wire firmly fixed to iron pickets, which had been driven into the ground, leaving the wire approximately 6 inches above the level of the sand. Obviously, this created a certain amount of confusion, and the leading elements, unfortunately, encountering this obstacle in the dark, fell across it and onto it. The Germans had trip flare alarms attached to this obstacle, which were immediately ignited, showing everyone up in silhouette. The enemy's guns had been cleverly sighted on fixed lines, firing at about 6 inches above the desert floor, and one could imagine the casualties which occurred amongst the poor chaps who had fallen across this wire obstacle. We later began to receive these casualties as they were brought to the rear. The stretcher bearers were out in force that night, and one in particular, a very close friend of mine, young Temple, went out with the raiding party, and not having had enough of that lot, went later out with the medical officer to recover wounded who could be here crying for help and had been somehow missed on the withdrawal. Temple went out, as I say, and helped the medical officer, along with other stretcher bearers and riflemen. The remainder of the wounded were recovered, thanks to their gallant efforts, and Temple was duly rewarded with a mention in the dispatches for his efforts.
The wounded that were coming back to you, what state were they in?
They were in deep shock. It was a night attack. They had been surprised. The boot was on the other foot, to put it another way. They had received a terrific jolt and were disgusted to find out that this previously unreported obstacle had put the kibosh on their plans. Most of the wounds were severe, gunshot wounds, small arms fire, and of course, once the company began to withdraw, the Germans held the gunfire and brought their mortars into action, which caused further casualties.
Were there any other medal awards for this particular action?
There were awards made. I can't remember the one. Of course, the one that sticks in my mind is one that young Temple got, being a close friend of mine. But I may be wrong in this respect, but I have an idea that the medical officer was awarded his Medical Cross for that operation.
After that, what happened? We're now into November, of course.
Well, this action took place on the night of the 9th of November. Although it was certainly not successful, the idea behind the action was to remind the Germans that although we were self-contained prisoners of war, we could certainly reach out and grab them now and again. And we were determined, the troops were determined to make the next effort a success. So on December the 7th, I remember, an attack was prepared on a situation point called 157. Four companies, which amounted to a battalion attack. We now know, of course, that it was time to coincide with the breakout of the Tobruk garrison to join it with the 8th Army advanced elements, who happened to be New Zealanders. The battalion went in with A Company left flank, C Company on the right, and B and D companies were held in close reserve, ready to make a bayonet charge, which eventually they did. The point in question was secured, but unfortunately during this action, towards the end, Adrian Keith, the company commander, was fatally wounded.
What was your role in this?
Our role in this was to be mobile, as we were, the medical officer, the battalion padre, whose name I still can't recall, was with us. We had our usual transport, stretchers, medical supplies, etc., and we followed at a slow rate along the road, along the top of the escarpment, behind the advancing companies. From this point, of course, we were sitting on top of our stores on the 3-ton truck. We had a good view of the whole action.
How are the companies attacked? Had there been an improvement on Capuzzo?
Certainly, the baptism of fire at Capuzzo had proved worthwhile, although a terrible cost. The Plonk exercise also had hardened the soldiers, and as I've said before, this time they really meant to make a whole do of it. They were, after all, in a battalion body, and as a battalion they went through. There were, I remember, one company on the left of the road, which ran along the top of the escarpment, and the other two companies were on the right. Captain or Major Keith's company was on the edge of the escarpment, overlooking our perimeter, which we'd recently vacated. And it was just toward the end of the action, when the last surrender was being made, that Adrian Keith received his fatal wound.
Was he a popular officer?
Extremely. A very handsome young officer, and at Saddlers.
Did you have many casualties to deal with?
Strangely enough, there were not a lot of casualties. By this time, of course, the field ambulance had dashed out of Tobruk, ready for such an occasion. Wounded consisted mainly of small arms bullet wounds, which we dealt with immediately at the regimental aid post, and as usual, they were eventually passed through. I would think that the casualties could be said to have been light in this respect.
This was a victory. Did it boost the men?
The following morning, when the stock was taken, I walked forward with the medical officer to walk around the companies, and the morale was at its highest point ever. They'd achieved the objective, and I'd been congratulated by the commanding officer who'd previously walked around them. At this point, of course, they were, as usual, were digging slit trenches for protection against air raid and possibly incoming ground fire. We were, at this point, receiving hot meal for breakfast. Everything was properly organised, and we were, as we thought, on the point of advancing up the coast to join the enemy once more in combat.
You mentioned that one company went in with the bayonet. Now, I know you didn't personally, but were you close enough to see just that action take place?
No, this is something we didn't see. It was till dark, of course, and there was little artificial light. The Germans and Italians, for once, weren't possibly ready to put the flares up that they usually did. I think they were surprised by the strength of the force opposing them, so we didn't see anything of the bayonet attack. But from what I gathered the next morning, talking to the chaps in the company, it was, as far as they were concerned, a most enjoyable experience.
After the attack was over, what did you do next?
Well, on the morning of the 8th, following the operation, the usual work had to be done. Rifles and other weapons cleaned, ammunition replenished, and equipment checked, so on and so forth. A roll call made, and the usual company inspections. We were then put about assisting Royal Engineer sappers in lifting certain mine panels laid by the enemy and putting down our own, in order to deter any possible counterattack. We were all expecting to spearhead a continued advance up the coastal road after the enemy, although it was known he'd only withdrawn a short distance. This, however, didn't come to pass, as on December the 10th, when the garrison of Tobruk was officially declared relieved, we were told that we'd be moving back. And in fact, on the 19th of December, shortly a week or so later, we were on our way back to Egypt, to the Delta area.
What were your feelings pulling out of that position that you'd been in so long under such conditions?
Well, everybody was disappointed, dismayed. We literally fought the way out. There's no other way to describe it. We'd been told to fight our way, take this position, which was which was blocking the road, and had been successfully carried out. And therefore, I think the chaps thought they were entitled to lead the continuing advance. So yes, I think the main feeling, or as I say, morale had peaked tremendously. There was a great disappointment amongst the men because we weren't continuing the advance.
Were you given leave when you got back to the Delta?
Yes, that was one of the first priorities. The companies organised the leave parties in the usual fashion, and chaps went off to the flesh pots of Cairo and Alexandria, where I learned how to enjoy frog's legs.
You say the flesh pots, what kind of entertainment was laid on for them?
Well, as far as we were concerned, being true desert rats, there was everything going. There were plenty of bars, there was plenty of good Stella beer, which was a good beer, incidentally. Coffee bars, there were cabarets of third class quality, but nevertheless, the ladies wore little and we spent a lot. The entertainment, as far as we were concerned, was first class.
Was there a problem with prostitution and VD when you went into leave situations like this? As a medical person yourself, you'd have experience of seeing this.
Yeah, well, this obviously was a problem, and we were constantly reminded, certainly when we were in rear areas and the opportunity presented itself, to beware of the possibility of infection. And it certainly was rife in that part of the Egypt, certainly. As a medically trained person, myself, medical officer and myself and colleagues, were in fact at the foot of Al-Fayr Pass, occasionally called upon to produce the necessary injections to combat this insidious disease. I'm afraid to say that certain wise guys considered in the early days that having contracted venereal disease, they would be shipped back to base into a soft hospital bed. This in the first instance was true, but it later was realised by the more learned hospital people, and certainly field medical officers, that the quite adequate treatment could be delivered in the field. And on occasion, as I say, in the saloon area, frequently there would be a line of Geordies with the bare bottom showing, with several needles issuing therefrom. And this is true.
What was the major treatment? What did you use?
I remember in those days there was a sort of a dual injection, one of arsenic and the other substance I just can't remember. But it certainly involved plunging needles into the both buttocks of the man's posterior. And I have an idea, it reduced the rate of infection somewhat.
In the rest situation and going off into areas where this danger was there, prostitutes with the disease, was there any kind of protective routine the men were expected to go through before they went in?
Oh yes, the protective sheath, French letters as they were called in those days, were a free issue. Although The more experienced chaps would tell you it was like putting on a Macintosh. This was up to them. There were other prophylactic preventive measures available, permanganates of potash washes. There were recognised brothels in these areas, but there were other unauthorised brothels in both Cairo and Alexandria, the Egyptian small towns. And as I say, a person had to be constant on his alert. I can honestly say at this point that having had my first warning as a young boy soldier, I skipped past these establishments and chose to get stupid on beer rather than go inside them.
If a man caught VD and hadn't gone through this protective phase, was that part of his offence or did it hide the offence?
Yes, if a person... It was an instruction, and the routine laid down was in British Army at that time that if a person, having found it or discovered he'd contracted this disease, he had to immediately report to his medical officer, who then reported it to the proper authorities, which landed upon the commanding officer's desk via the company commander. And if
the person concerned, if the infected individual had taken the recommended protective treatment, consideration was given to the punishment awarded, if any. However, on the other hand, if it was decided or found to be true that he had not taken protective or preventive measures, he was punished according to the scale laid down at that time.
And was that basically a pay punishment, loss of pay?
Yes. People involved in the desert campaign couldn't very well be confined to barracks, and the only way or the most severe punishment that could be awarded was loss of pay, and this was the norm in those days.
You mentioned that there are official brothels in these places. Were there official brothels for the officers also?
Yes, there were. Being young soldiers, never got round to realising what this was all about. It was the same action that was taken by all parties, as far as we're concerned, and rank didn't seem to come into it. But nevertheless, this was the way of the world at that time, and still is, as far as I remember. And yes, there were. There were other ranks, brothels. There were other ranks, drinking establishments. There were other ranks this and other ranks that. Not to say that certain wise guys didn't acquire pips and crowns and visit these establishments, usually getting away scot-free, but now and again the military police gentlemen grabbed them and whistled them off.
Alexandria and Cairo were big areas in the back. Did you come across many soldiers and military personnel who'd never been up the desert, who were base troops, which caused any kind of altercation from time to time?
Yes, that's a good question. The name given to these types were base wallers, and of which there were many. One thing that General Bernard Montgomery did in later months was to scour these people out and put them into fighting combat uniform, or send them home where they should have stayed. There were increasing numbers of these base wallers. One never quite realised what they did, but they were all dashing around in neatly pressed new KD, whilst we were wearing stained uniform, which had been laundered nevertheless. Base wallers were always a topic of conversation. If one came down in a leave train from the desert, from Matru or elsewhere in that region, you started to meet these people at the small stations en route to the Delta. For instance, a mobile bakery unit, a mobile bath unit. We'd never seen these units, but they were mobile. But they were only mobile to within 30 miles of the line. Yes, these jobs had to be done, and I suppose they're a necessary evil. But then again, I think the base wallers were looking after the base wallers. Strange to relate, now I don't want to offend our Scottish friends, that's the last thing I want to do, but it seems to me that each of these base waller units included a base waller wearing a kilt.
What happened after you came off leave?
Well, we were situated in base camps around the Delta region, of which there were many. A notable recollection is one that occurred whilst we were at a camp called El Tahag in the Delta area. Arrangements were made to move the battalion on block to a place called Kassasin, which is in the Bitter Lake area, for additional, as it said, invasion training, and rumours were rife once more. A decision was taken to move the battalion on foot. After all, we were infantry, and light infantry at that. Colonel Ardern, noted for his long stride and deliberation as far as marching was concerned, insisted that we carried our full kit, and of course as a stretcher bearing party we had our heavy stretchers to carry along. The Bren gun groups had Bren guns and the heavy tripods. The mortar platoons left the base plates in trucks but carried the barrels, and therefore as soon as we weighed down, the battalion set off in the direction of the Bitter Lakes on the morning of the 25th of December. The first halt was made almost two-thirds of the way towards our destination when the water trucks were brought forward, water not having been allowed during the march. Men were allowed to drink and refill their bottles from the attendant water bowsers, whilst the stretcher bearers, passing the ranks of the sleeping soldiery, were busy bursting blisters in the approved fashion. We got down to some kip at about 3 a.m. At first light, the battalion was roused, and after tea and a meagre breakfast, the march continued. On arrival at Kasasin, the roll was called. During the march, it was found that several people had occasion to drop out due to physical fatigue or other reasons. Colonel Ardern then asserted his authority as commanding officer of the battalion and decided that people who had not continued or completed the march according to instructions were inefficient, and non-commissioned officers who had been in this party were deprived of one stripe for a temporary period.